evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan and the rest of Africa this Wednesday, November 20th, 2024. Residents of Akobo Town took to the streets to demand for health services.
But in the hospital, at the moment, we have no fuel, we have no food, no medication at all. That is why you see all these people are coming and they cry.
And senior military leaders within Riek Machar's SPLA-IO speak out against what they call poor leadership style.
We don't want the new governor because in IO we work with Payams. The Payam that governed us was Bezilia Payam, and the person coming is also from Bezilia Payam.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents of Akobo Town have protested the lack of supplies and services at the county's main hospital in Jonglei State. Authorities and residents say the protests were prompted after reports that several people have died in the past 2 weeks because of an alleged lack of fuel for the hospital's generator. Mamer Abraham Kwart reports for VOA from Malakal.
We need help, partner. Welcome, welcome, help, partner.
Charichot Char, Akobo County Health Director, confirmed that more than 24 people have died in the past few weeks because of what he said was a lack of proper services at Akobo Hospital. VOA could not independently verify the number of people who died. Char says the hospital has no fuel and lacks major drugs, adding that more lives could be saved if the state and the national governments provide support.
When the ICRC left the hospital, we have very qualified hospital workers, and also they are able also to maintain all the service in the hospital. This majority of people are gathered here because people are dying. I really appreciate the health workers in the hospital because they give a good service to the whole community. We have surgical cases even they maintain, and also they give a good treatment. But in the hospital, at the moment, we have no fuel, we have no food, no medication at all. That is why you see all these people are coming and they cry.
A senior official at South Sudan's National Ministry of Health told this program that the commissioner of Akobo County, John Chual, is responsible for dwindling services in the county. Char calls on aid agencies not to abandon the people of Akobo.
And also to appeal to the UN, especially the UNMISS, also to give their reconciliation, and also to Akobo actually is a part of the South Sudan. And I would like to appeal to the government of South Sudan of this all to take action.
Galuit Chol, a resident of Akobo town, says the government of South Sudan and the aid agencies should intervene to save lives.
So they want to call the help from the government of South Sudan, and they also want to call the Minister of Health, the UNICEF, and the Care International, who is also taking up at the hospital, so that, and also to UN agencies, including also the UNMISS, so that they will know what is happening in Akobo. And they also see the situation of the Akobo community as the people. People are now finishing in the community because of hospital, there is no medication.
UNMISS representatives in Akobo, Colonel Kevin Singh, pledges the agency's support and asks the residents of Akobo to remain calm.
First of all, I'm really disheartened to hear the very sad news of those who have departed. And we really understand the deep sorrow and pain of the public. And definitely we have noted down whatever you have said, the points, the issues which local people facing here. We have noted down the points, and whatever possible from our side, we will definitely project the same in our channel also. And I'm sure definitely it will be over very soon. Help each other and take care of each other, and we are here to go together and support each other. And we will be always there for you.
The residents say services were cut in Akobo County when the International Committee of the Red Cross stopped supporting the hospital in August. South Sudan's National Ministry of Health promised to issue a statement on the situation of Akobo Hospital in Jonglei State. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Kwart, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
From health matters, we move to politics in Juba. Some SPLA-IO soldiers in Western Bahr al-Ghazal have rejected the appointment of Emmanuel Pirimo Okello as the new governor of the state. Okello replaced Sarah Kleto last week, but soldiers say Kleto and Okello come from the same village. The spokesperson for the SPLM-IO says they have resolved the matter and Governor Okello will soon travel to Wau. Dennis Longoni has more for VOA from Juba.
A power struggle between two factions of forces loyal to South Sudan's first vice president, Riek Machar, exists over who should be the next governor of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state. Some leaders of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, SPLAIO, an armed wing of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, SPLMIO, rejected the appointment of Emmanuel Pirimo Okello as the new governor of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state. Major General Peter Hakim Akpa, SPLAIO commander in Bagari, says the SPLM-IO is not following its own doctrines.
We don't want the new governor because in IO we work with Payams. The Payam that governed us was Bezilia Payam, and the person coming is also from Bezilia Payam. Our message is that we don't have a problem with the government or the IO, but we want to follow the system. We are not rejecting him because we have a problem with him, and no one will carry a gun because we reject that. We totally reject that.
Another SPLAIO Major General, Twal Twal, who is in charge of Wadlel Base, says he will defend freedom and justice within SPLM-IO.
When we fought to get our rights. Now, why is it that now we are not given our rights? Others are happy while others are suffering. That's why we refused him. The IO said they don't want him, and again now that they have appointed him. How? If he's happy to be appointed, we are not happy. That's why we are on standby.
Pog Baluang, spokesperson for the SPLM-IO, admits there was some disagreement after several names were proposed for the new governor of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state.
The person in question was recommending another person, and they didn't take it lightly that another person was selected, even though all of them, they were nominees on their part of the list. And this issue has been addressed internally by the party, and now we're expecting the governor to travel to the state headquarters as soon as possible.
General Hakim says SPLA in opposition military commanders should be given a chance to lead at the state level.
This is not my opinion alone, but this is our opinion as Bagari, after Jur River community, Raja community, and Mboro, and we have agreed so until Bazi, because the first opportunity was given to politicians, but now the opportunity is for others.
Baluang called on all SPLAIO soldiers to remain calm and respect the decision of the top leadership.
We understand the frustration that forces that go in, being in the cantonment and the training centers for almost 5 years, and we believe their frustration. However, a decision has been made by the leadership of the party, and according to the party's internal constitution and regulations, we must respect the leadership decision.
A week ago, President Salva Kiir fired Western Bahr al-Ghazal Governor Sarah Kleto Riyal, an SPLM-IO member and the only female governor in South Sudan. Several women groups protested Riyal's removal, calling it a violation of the 2018 peace agreement. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Ugandan opposition figure Kizza Besigye was charged with possession of an illegal firearm today when he appeared in a military court days after he was missing from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The military court in Kampala also charged the former president of the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, with soliciting military support in Geneva, Greece, and Nairobi to prejudice security of defense forces. Besigye went missing in Nairobi on Saturday. He was charged alongside FDC member Haji Lutale. The pair, who deny all charges against them, were remanded in custody until December 2nd. His wife, Winnie Binyima, the executive director of UNAIDS, wrote on the social platform X today that her husband was kidnapped on Saturday in Kenya and that she was reliably informed that he was being held in a military jail. Bisige's disappearance is raising concerns about human rights in Kenya. For more on this incident, we talk to Dr. Edgar Gichua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi.
The Kenyan government, current government, has lost its human rights direction because all these are violations against people's individual rights. There's a growing concern even within the Kenyan public that the government is overstepping its boundaries, especially even with not only with its citizens, but also even with citizens of foreign countries. We're talking about opposition leaders or people who somehow are not in good terms with governments from various places. And then when they're in Kenya, it's almost a guarantee that they will get kidnapped and deported against their will.
When you assess the overall thing, is there an extradition thing between Uganda and Kenya?
Thank you for that question. So this brings, even if there's an extradition treaty, it still has to follow law. Because in an extradition treaty, the government, assuming Uganda makes a formal complaint to Kenya that Kizza Besigye, who is wanted for this, and they list down the number of crimes or what it is that they are looking for him, and they request Kenya to formally expedite or make arrangements. Then Kenya, the government just doesn't wake up and do it. They're supposed to go to the judiciary. There is a court procedure. Kizza Besigye should go to a court of law in Kenya and defend himself on why he needs to be extradited or deported or not. Has he committed crimes? Does he feel he is safe? Is his life in danger? So there is due process. The problem now of these extrajudicial abductions is that they are outside the law. So Uganda makes a claim that we want Kizza Besigye because of treason or because of whatever crime they accuse him of. If Kenya does not verify that, we are going against international human rights law. We are infringing on his rights. Kenya is spoiling its image in the international diplomatic circles. We are spoiling our name. And remember, I think we sit on the Human Rights Commission. We sit on the Human Rights Commission. So it is purely ironical, very ironical, that we would be the ones perpetrating these atrocities, whereas we purport to protect and uphold human rights.
That was Edgar Githiu, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He was speaking with my colleague Yehes Wihu by phone from Nairobi. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, an opposition leader wins elections in Somaliland. Find out how after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And our words of wisdom for this Wednesday comes from Toknath or Nuer.
I'm James Roy Mujok from United States, Bantu Town, South Sudan. I have a proverb in my community language that say, Muguru didulun queer kiriel, ano kwalanga madeshoke lep. In English, to castrate a lion is not a problem, but who will open its leg? Sang.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The opposition leader in Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland was declared a winner on Tuesday in last week's election. Somaliland, which declared independence from Somalia amid a descent into conflict, has since sustained its own government, currency, security structures, despite not being recognized by any country in the world. Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament, tells VOA's Douglas Mpugwa that the peaceful elections are something to cherish and a lesson to the government in Mogadishu.
Well, I think the first thing is the peaceful way in which ordinary people voted is something to cherish and to welcome and to celebrate. That's the first thing. And Mogadishu can learn a lesson from this. But Mogadishu is deaf to the calls and the pains of the Somali people in the southern part of the country. That's the first thing. The second thing is elections have two phases. One phase is people going and freely sort of putting their ballot in the box. But what I don't see in Somaliland, a region of Somalia I come from, is that there is no civic, if I want to overemphasize that, there is no civic project. It's a sectarian project, and people, by and large, vote for tribes on the basis of tribes. And so there is no collective belonging on the part of the people where they are choosing between particular economic and political projects. It's a competition between sort of leaders of political parties whose ideas and spirit is anchored to tribalism and sectarianism. And there's nothing to celebrate at that front. So there are two phases. Celebrate the freedom that people have expressed. The tragedy is that it's not going to take it anywhere because it's organized on the basis of sectarian tribalism.
And there are those who think that the peaceful and well-organized election in Somaliland may help that country gain some recognition internationally. Do you share that view?
Well, I mean, it's ultimately the first place to go is the African Union. And the African Union, because of the treaty itself, has been categorical about that. So what the world should do is assist local people in that region of Somalia, Somaliland, to build their economy, to create a more civic-oriented identity rather than tribal identity, sectarian identity, instrumentalist identity. So there's a long journey to go. And I think all Somalis, whether they are from Somaliland or southern Somalia, will be best served if they bring their brotherhood and sisterhood together and face the world as a collective, get rid of the warlords, get rid of the tribal leaders, and create what the country had, Africa's first democrats, which is what Somalia was in the 1960s. That's the journey, not dividing the country into smaller and smaller pieces to satisfy political warlords.
That's Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Back in May, former President Donald Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to suppress damaging information ahead of his 2016 election. His sentencing was delayed until after the election. But now that he is the president-elect, what happens next is less clear. Tina Tran reports.
Will President-elect Donald Trump be sentenced for his crimes? It's a question that remains to be answered as New York State Judge Juan Marchand considers the extraordinary circumstances of a former U.S. president and convicted felon who also happens to be the incoming president. In May, Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels to suppress a sex scandal ahead of his 2016 election. Trump's sentencing in the so-called Hush Money case has been delayed multiple times, and his election victory earlier this month cast further doubt on legal proceedings. Anna Kaminsky is a professor at New York Law School.
Really, the core of this is to find out whether or not Trump's sentencing is going to move forward at all. And that includes whether it will happen before he takes office, whether it will happen after he takes office, or whether his case will just be dismissed.
Trump's defense team is arguing that a landmark Supreme Court ruling in July grants him presidential immunity and that the case should be dismissed entirely. But Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is arguing that the jury arrived at a guilty verdict prior to the Supreme Court ruling and that Trump was not president at the time. In a letter to the judge, he indicated that prosecutors would oppose attempts to dismiss the case, but were open to delaying sentencing until after Trump's term in office. Claire Finkelstein is a law professor at University of Pennsylvania.
If Juan Merchan decides that he agrees with the prosecutor's suggestion as a possibility, then he would engage in what might be termed an equitable stay, stay of proceedings, in light of the extraordinary circumstances of the defendant becoming a president of the United States, and he would effectively stay the case until 2029 after Donald Trump steps down from the presidency.
The hush money case isn't the only one the president-elect must contend with. Two federal cases brought forth by special counsel Jack Smith, one alleging mishandling of classified documents and another election interference, are reportedly being brought to a close as a longstanding Department of Justice policy cites that sitting presidents cannot be charged with the crime. However, an election interference case in Georgia does not fall under federal jurisdiction. Again, Claire Finkelstein.
Technically, the state of Georgia is free to proceed, unencumbered by the DOJ policy. But can they? Is it even possible to expect that they would be able to proceed and expect the cooperation of Donald Trump, which would really require the cooperation of the White House, to proceed with a trial while the defendant is serving as president of the United States?
Unprecedented circumstances have made for uncharted legal territory. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
From New York, we go to Brazil, where the leaders of 20 largest economies ended the two-day G20 summit in Brazil with a statement supporting developing world priorities on climate change, poverty reduction, and taxing billionaires. The final communique did not include strong language on Ukraine and Gaza that the United States pushed for. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakwaswara is traveling with President Joe Biden and brings this report from Rio de Janeiro.
As host of the G20 gathering of the world's largest economies, Brazil focused the group on the priorities of the Global South, countries generally considered as developing, plus Russia and China. Globalization has failed, said Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
A globalização neoliberal fracassou.
In the midst of ongoing turbulence, the international community seems resigned to sailing aimlessly through hegemonic disputes. We remain adrift, as if swept along by a torrent pushing us towards tragedy.
In a joint statement, the group underscored the need to slow global warming, reduce poverty, and impose a global tax on billionaires. It again called for an expansion of the United Nations Security Council beyond its five current permanent members. The statement also called for a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon and pathway to a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians, but did not mention Israel's right to defend itself, a line U.S. President Joe Biden pushes for in various global forums.
I ask everyone here to increase the pressure on Hamas.
As in last year's summit, G20 leaders highlighted the human suffering and economic impact of the war in Ukraine without any condemnation of Russia. The war is escalating as Ukraine begins using long-range weapons provided by the United States and Britain to strike inside Russian territory. Kyiv accuses the G20 of failing to act. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Today, G20 countries, they're sitting today in Brazil. Did they say something? Nothing. Nothing strong. This is the answer. So what strategy can be if even G20 countries don't have any strong strategy?
Support for Ukraine is on the minds of leaders ahead of the incoming U.S. administration of Donald Trump. President-elect Trump has criticized sending aid to Kyiv. In Biden's meeting with Lula, they underscored the urgent need to address the climate crisis, another area of uncertainty. Trump has repeatedly called climate change a hoax. Brazil ended the summit by passing the baton to South Africa, the next G20 president. Traveling with President Biden in Rio de Janeiro, Patsy Wida-Kuswara, VOA News.
Still on Money Matters, as the COP29 climate summit enters its final stretch in Azerbaijan, there are growing frustration over the apparent lack of progress towards securing a deal on climate finance, seen as a crucial step in reducing emissions and limiting global warming. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Money is dominating the final days of the COP29 summit, or, in COP terms, climate finance. Who will pay for poorer countries to adapt to climate change and to transition away from fossil fuels as their economies grow? Bolivia's delegate Diego Balanza, who chairs a negotiating bloc of developing nations, accused richer nations Tuesday of a decade of failed promises.
Our countries are suffering the impacts of climate change due largely to the historical emissions of developed countries.
COP29 is meant to set a new funding target for climate finance. Estimates vary. Some put the cost at $1.3 trillion per year. The current target is $100 billion. UN Climate Change Executive Secretary Simon Steele.
Climate finance is not charity. It is 100% in every nation's interest to protect their economies and people from rampant climate impacts.
A COP29 climate finance agreement is meant to unlock the crucial next stage of negotiations, allowing all nations to deliver action plans on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, with the goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. On the current trajectory, scientists say we're heading for a likely catastrophic 2.7 degrees of warming. There is growing concern at the apparent lack of progress at COP29. Mohamed Adao is the director of the campaign group Power Shift Africa.
This has been one of the worst COPs, at least one of the worst first-week COP that I've attended in the last 15 years. There has been very limited progress on climate finance and even on the rules around carbon markets and how the world is going to cut emissions.
Adao fears the negotiations in Baku are being overshadowed.
Around the election of Donald Trump and what the Trump administration is going to do. So you have the rich world that is actually hiding behind Trump and not wanting to actually respond to the calls that we've had from the developing countries on the $1.3 trillion US dollars that they require for climate finance.
Mukhtar Babayev, Azerbaijan's COP29 president, has called on parties to move faster amid growing fears that the summit might fail to reach an agreement. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
It's the remix, Yeah, money is money. We had a small fight in the studio here about where you should count your money. And for me, I will count it in the restroom. That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday, November 20, 2024. We'll now leave you peace with P-Square and the song Chop My Money. Unfortunately, you can't chop my money because I am in Studio 14. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Rob Macklins, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
I
Kabodina day you want baby. We supposed to live like family. Hey, I know the lie.
Know the lie.
There's nothing stopping me. She